This hour, we're asking the question, who owns water? And we've talked about the politics of water rights, but there's another way to talk and think about water as something alive, beautiful, sacred. Kimberly Blaser is the poet laureate of Wisconsin. She grew up on the White Earth Reservation, and she says the Anishinaabe stories about water made her who she is. Kim, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me.
I was going to ask, could you begin with a poem? And there's one I really love. It's called Wellspring, Words from Water.
I'd be happy to. Wellspring, Words from Water. A white earth childhood, water rich and money poor, vaporous beings transformed in cycles, the alluvial stories pulled from Minnesota lakes, harvested like whitefish, like Minomen, like old prophecies of seed growing on water. Legends of Anishinaabe spirit beings, cloud-bearer thunderbird who brings us rain, winter wendigo like ice woman, or Mishubishi who roars with spit and hiss of rapids, great underwater panther, you copper us to these tributaries of balance, rills, a cosmology of Nabi. We believe our bodies thirst, our earth, one element, Anabishabu, tea-browned wealth, like maple sap, amber, the liquid eye of moon. Now she turns tide, and each wetted being gyrates to the sound, its river body curving. We, women of ageless waters, endure, like each flower drinks from night, holds dew, our bodies a libretto, saturated, an aquifer. We speak words from ancient water.
That is such a gorgeous poem. Thank you, Kim.
You are welcome.
You begin that poem with the line, white earth childhood, water rich, and money poor. So you grew up on the White Earth Reservation in the upper Midwest. What made your childhood water rich?
In northern Minnesota, we always say land of 10,000 lakes, but it's more like 20 or 25,000 lakes. Mm. And where I grew up, there were lakes everywhere, some you could drive to, some you could hike to, some you may never see just because they were so far in the woods. But I spent nearly every weekend of my life on or near water, fishing, swimming, boating, skating, or watching, you know, photographing or writing about what I witnessed. And then, as if that weren't excess enough, as a young woman, I fell in love with the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness and with wilderness camping and canoeing and kayaking.
You make references in that poem to water spirit beings, too. Did you grow up with stories about them? What did you mention?
Many stories, yes. Yeah, stories about different beings and also sort of how those different beings help maintain balance. But one of the interesting things is growing up, we spent many weekends in the fish house. And fishing, you of course could angle, but also we had spear fishing that we were doing. So you have a big opening cut in the bottom of the fish house, and the whole fish house is dark. So you're looking down into, literally into the water world and become hypnotized watching it for hours and hours. And you're in this tiny little space with maybe four other people. And what do you do for hours but hear stories? And so many of the stories were about water beings.
Why are you so fascinated by water?
Part of my fascination is also with the way that water doubles everything for us. When you're on some vast expanse of water, and when the water is of a certain quality, the water gives to you a mirror image of everything that is surface, right? But it does so in such a way that you literally can't tell what's quote-unquote real and what's reflection or imaginary. So when the world doubles before you, it awakens your imagination. So there's this sense in which we, in this vastness of sensation, lose our groundings, right? And for moments, our preoccupation, or maybe even our realization of our own humanness or our ego. And just for those transforming moments, we become untethered. And maybe, if we're lucky, we feel like we belong to something larger than ourselves.
You know, we're talking about what changes if you think of water not so much as a natural resource or a thing, but if you start thinking of water as something alive, and then what flows from that. And it sounds like you're saying you think there are real moral and ethical implications that flow from that, as well as, you know, an entire way of seeing the world.
Absolutely. And I think you really hit on it, because I think the indigenous way of thinking about water is different than the kind of Western view that has, to this point, given rise to the laws and so on, because we should think about our relationship with water, the way that I was taught, as a reciprocal relationship, not as a stewardship, not we are some being that oversees water, but that we belong to water and water belongs to us, that there's a reciprocity.
Yeah, I'm thinking we're talking in the context of the protests at Standing Rock, which are about keeping water safe and clean. And of course, as the climate continues to dry, water is going to become more scarce. So it's going to make us all more appreciative of water and also more worried about water loss. But, you know, scarce resources in human history usually lead to conflict. So I'm wondering if Anishinaabe culture would suggest a way of thinking about our collective relationship and responsibility to water that might offer, you know, a different example, a different way forward.
I think that one of the things that's been happening a lot recently is that there has been this turn toward indigenous knowledge. I do think that there are people who are finally saying, maybe there is an other way of having a relationship with the natural world. And part of that would be to understand that we do not have all the power we think we do, because ultimately not everything is under our control, although it has seemed to be to a certain point in a capitalistic economy. Now people are coming to realize, as you said, that water is limited quantity. Recently this week, we had this wonderful poet, Craig Santo Perez, who is indigenous from Guam, and he read this amazing poem that he wrote in solidarity with the Standing Rock Lakota people about protecting the sacred waters of the earth. And in there, he has some lines. Can I share those with you?
Yes, please.
Sure. So there's a section where he says, which ties in so wonderfully with what you just said, water is life. Because we say stop, you are hurting our ancestors. Because they say we thought this was a wasteland. Because we say stop, keep the oil in the ground. Because they say we thought these bones were fuel. Because we say stop, water is sacred. Because they say water is a commodity. Because we say we are not leaving. Because they say we thought you were vanishing. Because we call ourselves protectors and water warriors. Because they call us savage and primitive. Because we bring our feathers and lei and shells and canoes and hashtags and totems. Because they bring their bulldozers and drills and permits. Because we bring our treaties and the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Because they bring their banks and paid politicians and lawyers. Because we bring our songs and schools and lawyers and prayers and ceremonies. Because they bring their barking dogs and private militia and National Guard. Because we bring all our relations and all our generations and all our live streams.
You know, it's interesting. So far, we've been talking, we started by talking in the particular about waterways you knew and loved growing up. And one of the things that struck me while you're talking is that I think that Anglo-European culture tends to, or the dominant culture, tends to describe water in the abstract or the collective, kind of the way I've been talking about it. But Native culture, Indigenous culture, generally has a much more nuanced and specific sense of place. So talking about water maybe should begin not with the general or generic, but with the particular. So is there one last waterway you know and love that you could tell us about?
Well, let me tell you a story. Can I tell you a story?
Please.
Okay, let me tell you about this experience I had in the Boundary Waters many years ago. So my husband and I were canoeing, and we had to start 5 lakes and 3 portages from where we really wanted to enter the Boundary Waters because there are limited access permits. So anyway, ultimately, it's night. It's already full dark, and we haven't arrived at a campsite yet. And so we are paddling in this vastness in the dark. And there are rocks everywhere, and there are tree stumps floating about. And so we proceed very cautiously. And then the moon rises, and suddenly everything is transformed. And there's this trail of moonlight that's following our canoe. But also the light is of such a quality that 15 feet in front of me, it looks like we will fall into the sky. And no matter that I know logically this is not true, it is so visually real that my heart is pounding out of my chest. And so I think that those kind of moments of finding ourselves in this other world where we are suddenly in an alternate environment is one of the ways that we can open ourselves to a different kind of relationship with place, because we are really tiny little human persons. We take up so little space in the vastness, but also we have a certain amount of insignificance when we realize how small we are. And maybe just one small poem about the Boundary Waters, a haiku that I had written that it really speaks that for me. Iron cold and wild, 1,000,000 wet blue acres drink in your smallness. So there's that sense of becoming something that's smaller than our imagination of what we were, that is humbling and allows us then to take a better position in our relationship with water.
Kim, thank you so much.
Sure.
Kimberly Blaser is the Poet Laureate of Wisconsin. She teaches Native American literature and writing at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee.